everybody. Welcome to Heat, Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood. We're here to call out stellar work by women in all parts of the film and television industries and share some shows and films we're excited about. Let us tell you a little bit about us. Hi, I'm Heather Fowler, a novelist and short story author with IP I'm developing into screenplays. My preference is weird, and my brand is Sexy Monsters Killer Women.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Monfrance, a writer and painter, and my brand is Kick-Ass STEM Women.
I'm Kiki Watkins, a writer, scholar, and producer, also an advocate for the arts. I love horror, and my brand is, if it's bad for your heart, it's good for your art.
Hey, I'm Carrie Sedmeyer. I'm a writer, director, producer, and actress, and my brand is Destiny Changemakers.
We chose today's topic, women in visual and special effects, to showcase women exceedingly skilled at creating these effects in films. For today's episode, with the focus on women in filmic effects, which include for the layperson audience the visual effects that are often created in post and added to the film, lighting effects, which are done on set and adjusted in post, and special effects, those used during filming, like makeup with prosthetics, explosion coordinations, etc. While the Oscars call the overall category, quote, visual effects, the winners are generally the people in charge of both visual and special effects departments. In viewers' shorthand, I think we can all agree on the concept that the effects are what make movie magic happen in a film, that let an audience believe in the events of the plot, believe they are reasonable in the fictive dream, and generally make the movie great. Carrie, did you want to start us off?
I'm happy to get us started off. For this episode, I picked Laurie J. Nelson, currently Senior Visual Effects Vice President for Warner Brothers Pictures, specifically and most recently on the film The Suicide Squad, which was released in 2021 and considered a standalone sequel to its 2016 predecessor, Suicide Squad. So the film I'm referring to is The Suicide Squad, which evidently started out as a joke when the film was being made because they brought on a new director and he would joke and say, this will be the Suicide Squad. And the film executives loved it. And so the name stayed, which is a little confusing because if you start to Google Suicide Squad, two will come up. So this one I'm speaking about is The Suicide Squad. The beautiful, talented, amazing visual effects producer that I'm highlighting is Laurie J. Nelson. But her work to get to this position as Senior Visual Effects Vice President, especially as a woman, was anything but easy. For a glimpse into Laurie's storied career as a visual effects trailblazer, let's hop into the DeLorean time machine and go back to the future. Okay, woo! We're back in the 1980s. Filmmaking era. Everyone, please take a moment to adjust their shoulder pads and their big hair as we dip into a time in filmmaking history where very few women worked in the field of special effects or visual effects. Laurie J. Nelson was one of the very first handful of women to break into this very male-dominated field. In an article that I read, a 2014 article from the online magazine The Mary Sue, it highlights the plight of women who worked in the special effects department in the early years. In the 1980s, special effects was created for movies by innovative science-minded specialists before computers could do their jobs. So these people were essentially the computers of today. Initially, the visual effects department was referred to as the optical effects department, as they dealt mainly with the science of light. And the use of real film, remember when movies were made with real film? Light and photography carried a heavier role in creating special effects than it does now, although it's still obviously very important. But at the time, every motion picture's last stop for final effects was the optical effects department, now called the visual effects department. When the doors cracked open in the 1970s vis-a-vis women's lib, amen, sisters, Laurie J. Nelson slipped in that door. Mm-hmm. She started with the industrial light and magic special effects arms of Lucasfilms. What a place to start. The ILM created the groundbreaking special effect films that we all know and love, such as Star Wars Return of the Jedi and Roger Rabbit, that had some of the best and most groundbreaking special effects known to man in filmmaking history at that time, and have been very difficult to duplicate since, especially Roger Rabbit.
I love that one.
It's an
amazing.
Amazing. I mean, what a talk about a feat where they came up with this idea to move a cartoon into a real action film and splice it back and forth. I've heard several interviews and podcasts from the creators of Roger Rabbit and that particular special effects sequence, and it's still not been duplicated to this day. And good reason why. It was very difficult, but they did it beautifully. So Lori was there working for ILM, and she started out as an optical lineup person. She was the sous chef, if you will, of the visual effects dude. So as it's noted in the Mary Sue article, the lineup person had to be astute in all of the sciences. This was considered an early STEM job, nod to Jennifer, STEM women, and specifically had to understand the mechanics of the optical printer of the era and how lining up shots had to be precise and was math intensive, as well as having to be very adept at film reciprocity, color density, and how film moved on sprockets through a camera gate. This is back when film was the medium.
This is so great. I love this history lesson, Carrie.
Thank you. I was fascinated when I found all this information out and how these early special effects chicks were like sciencey and brilliant and precise. And I'm like, these women, I love it.
Yeah, it's great.
It was great. And they talk about in this article how like the guys were really machismo in the like little room that they all had to work in together, but they somehow sweated it out and stuck to their guns and made it through. So in this article, which I found most fascinating, is Lori specifically talks about the hardest shot of her lineup career. It's dubbed, quote unquote, the pizza shot in the Back to the Future Part 2. She states it was a mind twister. She had to know the end, of course, before you started. And in this tasty, unforgettable pizza rehydration scene in Back to the Future 2, Lori and her optical effects team that she so skillfully worked with, they arranged the shots of the tiny dehydrated pizza in the beginning that was placed in a futuristic looking oven and came out full size, steaming hot and delicious looking. So it's kind of like a reverse of what we do today. We usually dehydrate food, but they rehydrate it. So in the Back to the Future, I love how they took a total twist on the rehydration, dehydration thing. And Lori talks about how they took up so many shots, like 70 shots for each plate. And they did it over like a maximum of 7 days for this shot. And she made two mistakes out of all of those shots, out of all of those days, and was like talked to. But eventually they got it precisely exactly right. And it became the iconic pizza scene that we all know and love today. So after that, Lori went on from the lineup optical position to become a VFX producer and consultant on many high-profile films. And she was instrumental in creating some of the most iconic scenes in visual effects history, working on films such as Virus, The Fast and the Furious, Batman Returns, Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, The Dictator, 42, Hunter Killer, and her most recent project, The Suicide Squad, as senior visual effects vice president of Warner Brothers Pictures. Lori has had quite an arc, and I find her extremely inspirational. And I know those early groundbreaking years were not easy. So let's get back in the DeLorean. We're back in the future.
Oh my goodness. I love it. We get a special effect for this.
That was my special effect. Yeah.
Like, I'm loving your special voice effects right now.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. I got a new microphone and I'm like kind of playing around with it. So thanks for indulging me.
Okay. Yeah.
In the Suicide Squad, Lori and her visual effects team brought to life characters like King Shark and the surreal scenes featuring Harley Quinn, played by the beautiful Margot Robbie. While special effects contributed to the film's intense action and sequence scenes with real explosions and intricate makeup, visual effects allow for the creation of scenes or elements that are impractical or impossible to film in real life. And the examples in Suicide Squad are the King Shark, a completely CGI character, bringing a half-man, half-shark creature to life. And when I read more about how this character was created, they really wanted to give him a dad bod to make him look different than the typical shark characters that had been created before. And I thought that was absolutely hilarious.
That's so funny because he's also kind of dumb. Yeah. And
his life is all about just like eating things and people. He's got a one-track shark mind.
No.
They were having that meeting and he's like, hand.
I know. He's like, yes. And Viola Davis is just like, yes, that is your hand. And she just moves on. I mean, she killed it in this movie. I love Viola Davis. And she was in her little lilac suit. She looked so commanding in a lilac suit. It was amazing.
She did.
Harley Quinn's javelin scene, the fight scene with the javelin, is enhanced with digital effects to add a surreal and colorful explosion of flowers and birds. And
that was so magical when she was fighting, because I was just like, oh my gosh, I was so entranced with all the like cartoonish magical aura that she's around, because she's like this total killer, but she has this innocence about her.
She does. I mean, it's a really complex role if you look at it.
Yeah.
That lens, really. And I can't help but think that Laurie Nelson and her visual effects team borrowed some ideas from Roger Rabbit in all of her early years and earlier films to really create this very unique scene.
I would just want to say that the rat with the backpack.
Oh my God. That's... I want a rat now with a backpack.
I know.
So flipping cute.
Once I saw the rat with the backpack, I was like, this is the real star of the film.
Yeah.
And then at the end, I never knew that I wanted Idris Elba to pet a rat.
Or... That was the most touching part of the film.
So right. So I was sweet. Just like, oh my God, you guys, they're friends.
I was crying. I'll admit it.
Wow.
Because it was such a juxtaposition of Idris Elba, who's just such a beautiful, incredible man, and his tenderness, even though he's like, you know what I mean? It was just beautiful. Yeah. And
it was cool because the story arc, I thought it was really emotionally how you get attached to this obviously CGI rat.
Yeah.
And because of his backstory with how his father treated him and then yes. how he became attached.
And I have to say, I was touched in multiple moments in this movie. Initially, I was shocked at how quickly I was attached to Weasel. And when Weasel dies in the water.
Oh, and then now we get like at the end, all the credits go.
And there he is.
The coughs up some water.
And there's the end in the credits.
Yeah, and now all the bad stuff is gone. He's fine. He's like, yeah. they already considered him dead. So he's just free.
Right. And I knew that kind of in the beginning. I was like, I bet he's going to survive and he's going to be like, see you later.
you know, in real life, the Weasels typically don't get a happy ending. I'm happy he was able to get a happy
too.
Ending. You know,
worldwide.
I think that this just like highlights what's so important about special effects, right? You guys bond with these characters, and when they feel real to you, that's where the emotion comes, right?
Absolutely.
And so, yeah.
It's how they give them like the facial effects, but melding the shots that they have to get with the human. And it wouldn't be the same without the live action human element. So the brilliance really comes down to blending these CGI special effects, visual effects with the human element. With only one or the other, it's not as great. But when you pair the two together and make a fusion, if you will, that's
yeah. And you know, the part where the rats come in,
yes,
because she was the sensitive emotional one, because we know that the peacemaker was anything but,
right?
And she became the emotional core of it and changing other characters and their emotional connections. And then when she does the rat thing, those small little rats, and you're just like, go rats go.
I know.
And you always I was always looking for the little rat with the backpack, and I was like, you better survive, man.
I was never excited to see rats in a movie. This one really did it for me. Like,
yeah, they became a whole character. And then going to the eye, the special effects of when she goes into the eye with her lance.
Yes.
And floating there, and all the rats like swimming into the eye.
Oh, yeah.
That was so beautiful and visually stunning.
It's so intense. And you have to wonder if the amazing work that was done on these earlier films, like I think about it all the time. Has anybody seen the show Sweet Tooth with all of those little animal creature children? Yeah. I'm wondering what a gift the past is to the people in the present. Right? Of doing this sort of thing.
even though they've moved mediums chiefly from film to digital now, they have to stand on the shoulders of all of those pioneer special effects, yeah, visual effects creators. And a huge nod to these women that walked into a really filmmaking in general was all men.
Yep.
And there were very few women, very, very few people of color. And it was just very brave. And they didn't just lay the groundwork. Any woman or minority moving forward that steps into these roles is really standing on the shoulders of all of these brave women and individuals that really had to break through in an era. And we're still dealing with that in an era where it's so difficult still to this day. But imagine if they hadn't done the work they had done to bring us where we are today. So we can take their energy and carry the torch forward, thanks to them. So it was a pleasure to talk about Lori Nelson today. And that brings me to Heather. Heather, what would you like to share today?
Well, I'm totally excited to share some information about a woman who worked on one of my favorite films, which is a sci-fi cult classic called Dark City. And this film came out a year before The Matrix. And so the woman who was the visual effects supervisor at this time, her name is Mara Bryan. And Dark City is a neo-noir, high concept, now kind of a cult classic film. And you'll recognize the people in it because there are some pretty big stars. Jennifer Connelly, Rufus Sewell, William Hurt, Kiefer Sutherland, Richard O'Brien, and Ian Richardson are the actors in the movie. And the story and the screenplay were both written by director Alex Proyas, but the screenplay was also written by Lem Dobbs and David S. Goyer. So for a quick sum of the plot, because you guys know I like a freaky movie, that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, we know your taste now.
We know you like the weird stuff.
Yeah, weird stuff. So at any rate, for a quick summary of the plot, we have a man beset by amnesia slowly discovers that he inhabits an alien world run by strangers who experiment with learning the origin of the human soul by imprinting a captive human population with constantly rotating lives, memories, and personalities.
Ooh.
But also the strangers are constantly changing the world and its physical architecture and the landscape each night with a process they call tuning, where buildings just emerge from thin air and morph into new maps of a constantly altering city. I was very excited to pull out her work here, and also that she was already way back when a supervisor, visual effects supervisor, back in the late 90s. To me, that's just a true leadership ability. That's charisma, that's talent, that's all the things. And when I heard this interview about her, one thing that I really liked was she basically was talking about being a tech geek and being one of very few people who had a lot of the skills with some of the skill sets that they needed in this developing film. And I also picked this film because it features some of the most visually memorable scenes in my filmic memory. And these were created by lighting, script, special effects, visual effects, choices with model photography, CG animation, 2D morphing, and the 2D morphing often playing with color saturation during the memory shots.
Mm.
The whole film is just so fabulous to watch. And something super compelling about Mara is that I just love how she is so down to earth and so amazing when I hear her being interviewed, and yet very in command of what she's doing. So here's a little bit about her past and history and what she's done. She worked on Judge Dredd as an effects coordinator and freelanced with productions after that. And like I said, she was one of the few people with this visual film techniques, kind of the tech geek. And after this, she worked on GoldenEye with a tiny budget, which even she acknowledged, of 10,000 pounds for wow, the optical effects in GoldenEye. That's a James Bond film. And so what she mentioned, which I thought was great, which I wanted to share with you guys, is she mentioned she only had the budget to do 150 shots. And wow, after that, she said digital effects just became so much more mainstream. And so for contrast, at the time that the interview was recorded, she said there were 1,600 in the latest Bond movie. Isn't that crazy?
That's similar to what the article about Lori talks about.
Yeah.
Where they had only so many shots, even though it took them several days just for the pizza shot, because it had to be exactly right. But, you know, they had to work 10 times as harder with much less.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So, and she also did 4 Bond films, and then she went back to New Zealand and she did Dark City in Australia, which, by the way, Dark City, this is, I found this to be really interesting, was entirely filmed on a set.
I can tell that it's a total set because it's a contained.
Contained.
It yeah. sort of like also lends to the claustrophobic environment, you know,
that's because true.
Even when we pan out and we see what the actual Dark City is, which is like a flat earther's dream.
Right. I was going to say that.
Right? I mean,
that's exactly what it looks like.
Yeah. And so they probably yeah. are like, look at Dark City. This is what it's really like. But
oh my gosh.
There is a claustrophobia to it because yeah. they're trying to get out of this reality and they don't even know what the reality is.
Yeah. She then ended up doing tons of work and became the SX manager for Avatar, among her other credits. And nice. In the VFX Insiders podcast, she spoke to her work there and experience. So I just wanted to shout out that podcast for their feature with her.
Awesome.
Yeah. So about Dark City, she did intensive work. I think it's so cool to find out who people collaborated with. And in Dark City, she did a lot of intensive work with Peter Doyle, who is now just huge in the work that he's done. He's best known for championing the digital color grading on Peter Jackson's The Lord of the Rings trilogy. In an article called Dark City at 20, he says, Mara Bryan was the visual effects supervisor. It was an interesting film in that it was a hybrid of the model and miniatures work and practical effects and digital. My role was really to put the team together and work out with Mara the best breakdown. Okay, we could do that with CG, or that's going to work better with models. It was so yeah. cool how collaborative they were. He said on this set, it was really egalitarian. He said politically, there was one philosophy that might be interesting to note in that when I put the team together, we had a mutual agreement to try and experiment. You could say it was almost naive in some ways or optimistic. The group of us was really small. I think maximum, it was about 20 people.
I can't believe that.
That's amazing.
20 people. Yeah.
That's an incredible feat.
Yeah. yeah. And then he says, but the core group, we all agreed that we would try to keep the hierarchy flat, like your flat earth theory, but in hierarchy.
In practice.
Yeah.
And in theory.
Yeah.
That's very innovative and trailblazing of them to keep the hierarchy flat.
Very cool. Very cool. And the other thing is he just basically said everyone had a true involvement in the process and the entire team would, in fact, interact with the director. So
amazing.
Nice.
That's cool. There are so many gorgeous and impossible moments in this film that translate believably. I love when William Hurt's character was breaching the space barrier and floating out into space. Mind blown. I love that. The nuance of how that was done was just absolutely beautiful. And then also one of my other favorite scenes in the whole movie is when one of the strangers, oh, and the strangers are like these creepy aliens who are using human corpses and they're like this glowy little alien thing inside of the human corpse. So one of the strangers has the top of his head cut off and then you see the little glowy alien coming out of the body.
Oh, that was
I remember that.
I remember that. I was in front of that advertisement for the beach that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And when it came out, because you're just like, ew, that's what's controlling them.
I enjoyed the power brainwaves.
Yes. I thought that the visual effects of their intensity, like, you know that they're just sitting in a soundstage just staring at each other. Right? But it looks so amazing when they're doing the stand-up and all the waves.
During the tuning. I love it. And then also when the buildings are morphing, that is fascinating. I loved watching some of the buildings shoot up and expand, and the scene when they have that couple and the table stretches and then gets set in front of the couple that they're changing their personality.
I love that part. Mm-hmm. I love that part because it's so funny how they're so into the details. I'm just they put candelabras on. I mean, they brought them food and he's just like, you'll probably have a servant's quarters. And they
morning or something.
And how they totally just like didn't realize their whole life had changed in a moment.
Yes.
Their whole existence.
Yeah.
And not even missing a beat. They've had their memories inserted. And so they're like, okay, we're rich now.
But even the caliber of the conversation had changed. Like they were having this general conversation and then it's on a whole other level because they're in a whole other class of citizen.
Don't even get me started on how cool the syringe in the head is in this movie.
It was scary because it would spin around like a power tool.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just so imaginative and so beautiful. And so many elements of this I just love so much. I loved that moment. And I don't think I'm killing anything because the film has been out for quite some time. But I love the moment when the main character is creating an ocean in the force field protected area of space toward the end. That is killer.
You know, it's really, really cool too.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole thing, so gorgeous. That's all I can say is that this movie is just worth watching just because it's fascinating. It's well acted, well directed, but the special effects are really what's bringing it home for me. What made it a classic for me.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. You
know, the thing is about the water, though, just a science aspect. It's just like this thing isn't spinning. The water would just go off into space. How is it just sticking there?
It's a force field around the thing is what I was thinking.
It's a force field.
Yeah, you see the field like when William Hunt's character breaches it and starts floating out into space. Before that, he's just kind of hanging there. And then you see him breach the little barrier when he starts floating way out. So,
okay.
There's a little barrier.
See that little cloud.
Little orc cloud holding it together.
Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that even before that, the fact that he floats out, even before he breaches, that's a lack of gravity. So, you know, that water wouldn't stick. I mean, it's fine, but I'm just saying, hey, flat earthers, no.
That's
not how it works.
No.
I'm willing to suspend my disbelief for anything gorgeous enough.
I mean, if you question your reality, that's when you know the job has been done.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And when he brings out the sun, first time, like that third act of bringing in light to the dark screen.
That was incredible. And I love the super saturation of the colors on the pier at the beach when he meets up with Jennifer Connelly's character again. Like, so much of that is beautiful with the sun at the end.
It is. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah. So, Kiki, who did you pick?
This month, I chose Sheena Dougal. And I hope I'm saying her name properly. She's British. Sheena Dougal is an award-winning visual effects supervisor, director, and compositor and designer whose standout work has shaped visual effects, blockbusters, and extraordinary short films. She's an acclaimed visual effects supervisor known for The Hunger Games, which came out in 2012, Agent Carter from 2015, Body of Lies, 2008, Venom and its sequel. Venom came out in 2018 and Venom Let There Be Carnage came out in 2021, and then Ghostbusters Afterlife, which came out in 2021. She was awarded the 2020 Visual Effects Society Award for Creative Excellence, which honors individuals who have consistently produced compelling and creative imagery in service to the story. And she's also been nominated for Best Special Visual Effects. Sheena, she was born in Manchester, United Kingdom, and now lives in Venice, California, to be closer to the studios. A few fun facts that I found about Sheena is she previously designed album covers, having had the opportunity to conceptualize the cover for Traveling Wilburys Volume 1 with George Harrison, who was a member of the Beatles.
Yeah.
She also volunteers with EPA, helping to save endangered species, which is great. Oh, I thought that was really sweet.
That is wonderful. What a great fact, Kiki.
Right. A quote of hers that I found interesting is, "The lack of female visual effects supervisors is definitely the result of a lack of opportunity and I'd say unconscious bias. It never really occurred to me that my gender should hold me back, and I was always surprised when it did. I am a strong believer in diversity and inclusion, not just because I am a biracial woman, but because I believe that greater diversity leads to freer thinking and greater creativity."
I love that quote. Awesome. Absolutely right.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Sheena has a love of film and believes that visual effects are where art and technology collide. I chose Venom this month to highlight Sheena's stellar work in visual effects. If you haven't seen Venom, you're in for a real treat, as a transformation of Tom Hardy's character Eddie Brock into Venom is nothing short of amazing. A lot of comic book adaptations fall short of fans' expectation, but this film does not disappoint. Not only is the story great, but the effects are phenomenal. transformation is key here. And I love how malleable the ooze is of the symbiotic creatures, how the form and structure just make everything about the effects otherworldly.
The
way that it transforms from liquid to solid, forming weapons and sticking to odd places. And I feel like it all also represents the shadow aspects of our personalities.
It's so cool, especially the scene where he's riding the motorcycle through San Francisco.
Yeah.
Chasing and all the inventive ways that they use that ooze.
Right?
Yeah. One time he was like, the ooze took him around this corner and just like totally swung him around. The choreography with the ooze. I know that that was a visual effect, but
yeah, for sure.
It totally matches up. It's incredible the amount of creativity they use with that.
Oh yeah. In so many of the scenes, it's used slightly differently in that you can see what the ooze would do in different circumstances, you know? I love when it takes the dog.
Oh. Right? It's
like, yeah.
But then when they leave the dog, doesn't it probably die?
It probably eats the dog.
Yeah. But yeah, they kind of left that part out.
They didn't want anything bad happening to the dog on screen.
Probably. But it's how Michelle Williams, because the dog looks at her, and it's how she becomes an ooze barrier. And I really love how they made Venom like someone that I wanted to root for, because especially Eddie, you are a loser. And then he's like, but I'm a loser on my planet too.
Yeah, kind of like great minds think alike, you know? Right?
That's why they're so compatible, because they're losers.
Yeah. I love it too that the Venom character is the underdog alien. So the root for the underdog is in both the human and alien flipping the script there, which is cool.
You always kind of root for an underdog.
Right? And, I've never seen that before where they have an underdog and then there's a better alien that's not the one that you're with.
Yeah. A nastier, bad alien. Big, bad alien.
He was like, look at him. He's just like, oh no, we're going to lose. He's like, we don't have any chance against this guy.
Let's go.
Let's go anyway. But what's funny, do you remember the kiss between Eddie and Anne?
Yeah.
That was nominated for best kiss with the MTV film. Was the MTV Movie Awards that year?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was a great kiss.
It was hot.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
I love how as the film progresses, we can see how the symbiotic alien element selected their host and how if symbiosis wasn't achieved, that the host body was consumed. So you wonder if the dog got eaten, but they don't really give into that.
But we know that the dog was kind of annoying, so we don't care.
Yeah. I feel like the symbiosis matches the darker aspects of our own personality, and Sheena's work really makes me wonder what my symbiotic self might look like. So I had a lot of fun. So I also had to go back and watch The Hunger Games because I want to go back and watch
it. I love The Hunger Games. She was involved in that, right?
Yeah, she was. Yeah.
I know. I was looking at some of her work as well because I was interested in her. That's so cool.
She was a great pick. She's so accomplished.
I'm excited to see more women make headway in this arena and in the industry.
Yes.
So. And something I really loved about this film is it was so entertaining and humorous at the same time as feeling like a comic book, but it felt like it really had a four quadrant appeal to it. You know, it didn't feel quite as much of male audience driven because it felt like it had moments that were just really intrinsically so cool that anyone could appreciate them.
I absolutely agree. She, even though they left her behind because, you know, they had to fight, and then she used But I know you're just like, okay, men, go. But she used the frequency, Carrie.
Yes.
She used a frequency.
Yeah.
Yeah. Full circle moment here.
In time.
I thought that was really interesting when it was just like, well, what hurts you? And he's just like the MRI, high frequency, and then also fire. Right. And so remember when he was just like, goodbye, Eddie, because he made the
rocket. I love your Venom voice, Jennifer.
He made the rocket explode and then he was parachuted down. And then you think, oh, Venom's gone and you're all sad, but he's not.
Yeah, right.
We're going to
get her back. She doesn't know we're going to get her back, Eddie.
I know. How did he Kiki with a voice right
now. And to your point, Kiki, about like our shadow selves, it's like a kink and she's game with it. She's yeah. like, man, I've met your kink and I'm cool with it because that kiss. Yeah.
Right. You gotta love people who appreciate the darker aspects of our personality.
Yes. You know? And she, yeah, very accepting.
I kind of wanted Venom to take her more often. Hope there's like even more sequels.
I think there's actually a third film coming out this year or next year, okay. but I'm not sure.
It is. That's right, Kiki. And it stars Juno Temple from Ted Lasso.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I loved watching this film too, because I try to figure out which neighborhood they were in San Francisco. She lived in North Beach and he was more like in Chinatown.
So. I know nothing about San Francisco. I've never been to the West Coast. We got to fix that.
Well, yes. Yes, we do. You need to come west.
Yes.
Like the pioneers.
Oregon Trail. Who'd you pick, Jennifer?
Well, I picked Lindy DeQuatro. I love saying her name, so I'll be saying it a lot. She, isn't that a cool name? Lindy DeQuatro.
Yes.
She's wow. a visual effects supervisor for Industrial Light and Magic, that's also known as ILM. And she's a huge resume. So recently, she was the visual effects supervisor for Atlas and was also the supervisor for Dora and the Lost City of Gold, which she really enjoyed because she liked having a female protagonist. And The Great Gatsby. She was also co-supervisor for Pacific Rim. It had, if you guys have seen it, it's like robots and stuff like fighting. And an associate visual effects supervisor for Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol. And she also was the sequence supervisor for Minority Report. And when she first started out, she was the digital artist for the film Magnolia. And
wow.
this is just a sample list. There's a lot more if you go to her IMDb, but the last three I mentioned has Tom Cruise as a star. And so Lindy, what's up with Tom?
A lot of paperwork. She can't tell you anything.
I know, right? She can't tell me anything. I know. But
well, I mean, Minority Report is a visually beautiful film with tons of great effects too. So I'm just like, that's awesome. That's amazing.
Yeah, she really enjoyed it. So when she, like, what do I want to be when I grow up? When she was growing up, she was really good at math and science. And she also took community art classes. And so then she double majored in computer science and art. And then she decided to get her master's in computer science at USC because they had a good graphics program. And so while she was in school, she did a film project and it was called A Sailor's Tattoo. And then that led to internships at Sony and Art Greenberg LA, where she worked on Mortal Kombat, which is based on the video game. So she really liked working for smaller companies because it gave her the opportunity to do her own layout, animation, lighting, rendering, and composition. So when she interviewed for ILM, they asked her if she wanted to be an animator or a technical director. And she's like, well, I'd like to do both. And they were like, no, you have to pick one. And so she goes, which one leads to the visual effects supervisor? So she became a technical director. And in her latest film, Atlas, she worked with the director of photography, production designer, stunt coordinator, and special effects supervisor. And so this is what we were talking about before, like how much of a collaboration it is. And Lindy believes that visual effects is a very powerful tool, but should only be used when something is too expensive or too dangerous or impossible to do practically. So that brings me to my pick, because the thing that's impossible about The Great Gatsby is just the world.
Yes.
It's magical and gorgeous. And Baz Luhrmann directed it. From the very beginning, the visual effects starts the storytelling. There's the snow that's just so beguiling. And you see this beautiful and enchanting castle thing, but then you get close to it and you realize it's a sanatorium. And that's really like the whole story of facades of beauty concealing a darker truth.
Good summary.
Wow. That's deep.
Right. Well, I read the book. So
yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Yes. And I really loved how close it was to the book and explained a lot more of how everyone interacted. So the cinematography and the visual effects just really conjoin to make this vision super over the top, creating this atmospheric powerhouse. You've got the Technicolor party scenes and those spectacular fireworks. And that's where the meme comes from. Do you guys know that meme when he's...
Oh, yeah. With Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah. Yeah. With the champagne coup and the fireworks in the background. Yeah.
I was like, when I saw that, I was like, oh.
Yes.
It's so great because you know that they use visual effects for the fireworks and how well it matched the Technicolor of the party, just all the colors. And so I also really liked how they did zooming and using the visual effects to throw you back and forth from the house, because it was like where she lived and where he lived, where Gatsby lived and where Daisy lived, and the green light, and how you can swoop back and forth between the two. Also, I think that that house does not exist. That's got to be CGI. It was just so huge. It has to be,
but right? It's how I imagined it visually when I read the book too, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and how huge it was. So when Gatsby and Daisy were together, I noticed these little orange lights dance around them in the forest. And it created this sort of intimacy within the story, but we're always the outside. We're always looking in because we don't really know what their full relationship is like. And then also I want to say the stars, the starry sky. The
stars were amazing.
Yeah, they were.
And how you could see that. And then it also made me think about light pollution and how we can't see that anymore. But I also feel like since she works for ILM, that they probably have a catalog of stars because, you know, they did Star Wars. So they're just like...
I would love to just be able to go through that catalog, like somewhere, and run through a catalog of starry skies. Like, yeah, totally. That has to be like bucket list. I put that on my bucket list.
Use it in a little home theater complex. You just put seats in your house and have it project on the ceiling. That'd be great. Yeah, totally.
So that you're in it.
Mm-hmm. Immersion. Yeah.
And I also wanted to give a real hearty applause to the costume designer, Catherine Martin.
Oh, they were beautiful 1920s.
Oh my God. Yeah. They were so intricate. Each person.
The hair pieces. Oh my God. The head hair pieces. Oh my God.
I like, and I think the director may have had an influence on this too, because Baz Luhrmann had done Romeo plus Juliet, like, you know, Romeo and Juliet, that version with
I remember that one.
And Moulin Rouge.
Leonardo. So
and,
he was
oh,
already,
yeah, that one too.
And Moulin Rouge with Nicole Kidman. Yeah. And I think the visual aesthetic of lushness was a carryover from something stylistic that he wanted. So I think the effects people really brought exactly what kind of thing he likes connected to his work.
I agree. I think it was a true collaboration because you could tell that there was a lot of pre-visualization of how this was going to work and everyone brought their A game. I mean, Lindy DeQuatro, we all want to say her name, Lindy DeQuatro.
Yeah.
I have to say I've never seen a film translate so well from a book. I still haven't encountered it.
It brought to light so many things that Fitzgerald was writing about the excessive wealth, because it's hard to imagine the hugeness of their wealth.
I have a question about what your opinion is about this. Chapter one, they talk about the green light in the book, and then they bring it into the film. And then at the very end, and he builds his house so he can see the green light at each evening that hangs over Daisy's house. And if you look it up, and there's different opinions of what the green light symbolized for Gatsby in the book and in the film, but I'm curious, what do each of you think, or your thoughts on what the green light really symbolized, and how the visual effects people created the green light for the film, and how that compared to the green light that you saw in your head from the book?
I've thought a lot about this, and of course, I took a course on it, and we talked a lot about the green light. I think that it's interesting that Daisy doesn't realize there's a green light, nor does Buchanan realize it. He's really the only one who sees it.
Yes.
So I think that he has this vision. It only took him 5 years to make all that money because he was penniless, which is just incredible. This green light for him is the money, is the unattainable. I think it's an idealization of what he thinks life should be like.
Interesting.
What do you guys think?
I feel like he used that as like maybe a metaphorical touch point for him to do what he needed to do to become the person that he thought he needed to be to have her.
Ooh, that's deep.
Oh, that's good. I agree with that as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Heather.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the quote in The Great Gatsby. If it wasn't for the mist, we could see your home across the bay, said Gatsby. You always have a green light that burns all night at the end of your dock. And So to me, it's always the unattainable thing, the desired thing, the thing that you have envy toward, the thing just out of reach.
Yeah.
He could actually see it or imagined it so deeply that he could see it. And it created this longing or focal point for him. And I wonder, did he really truly, if the character was a true life character, did he really see it himself visually like an aura? Or was it a spiritual message left to linger for giving him inspiration or something to reach for? I don't know. I can't land on what my exact feeling. It's green, so it makes you think of money and wealth.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, green also means go.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true, you too. Know. Well, so. And when Boz shot him looking up at the light and having his hand out.
Yeah.
Like he wanted to grab it, the whole ideal that he is longing for.
Did he want to grab it or did he want to go with it or become with it or get into it somehow? Like
I think he wanted to be it, right?
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. I think he wanted to become it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about it being a symbol or metaphor for the American dream, as yes. well as the more intimate relationship with Daisy. And yeah. I think that's an interesting thought too, because what is it really? What is light if not ephemeral? What is light if not something that can be darkened? You know,
it's that's like, true. Yeah,
you can't hold it, or you can appear to hold it, but it's not the physical realization of something.
And it was only him that saw it. They're yes. like, what green light?
Right?
Yeah, right.
And so only he could, it was his dream.
It's a little individual for each person when they read the book, see the movie, what they think the green light really is. And it's left ambiguous. It's for the audience, the viewer, to interpret. And I love that about the film, the book, that it makes you ponder and think after. And I think it's just a powerful film.
That's the beauty of art,
right?
That it's open to interpretation, that it gives us the space and the freedom to develop our own perspectives.
Beautifully put.
Well, what a great list. Okay, so we will post this list on launch day at the Hot Redhead Media blog. So you can all go check out these awesome films and let us know if you have more to say about them. But what snacks do we need for this movie watching extravaganza? Whose turn is it to offer the snack today?
It's mine. And I bring Yay. To you in our beautiful summer season, the 4th Ooh. Of July fruit salad.
Gotta love 4th of July.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Kiki, for your service. And we need to celebrate the great freedoms we do have. And so why not celebrate it with a red, white, and blue salad? It's delicious and chilling and refreshing for summer. Ingredients are 8 cups of cubed watermelon. I used a medium-sized watermelon. It should be more than enough. 4 cups of fresh blueberries, 4 cups of fresh jicama. And if you want to get fancy, you can cut it into little stars and add those little stars on top. It makes it very visually appealing. You can also add a cup of pitted Bing cherries and a cup of stemmed strawberries. Or you could even just keep it simple with just strawberries or watermelon, one or the other, blueberries and the jicama.
I have a question. I've never heard of jicama. So like,
oh, I've got a whole lot of information on jicama. I'm so
okay.
glad you brought that up, Kiki. Jicama is a root vegetable native to Mexico and Central America. It is filled with a crunchy texture and a mildly sweet flavor, but it's versatile. It's very fluid. You can eat it with savory things or you can eat it with sweet things. If you cut it like in strips, it almost has like a chip sensation to it, and you can dip it in salsa or guacamole, or you could add it to a fruit salad or other sweet food recipes.
Wow.
It has a really interesting taste. It's sort of akin to a radish. But it's
really I love radishes. I love radishes. That's amazing. And you got to love something that's sweet and savory at the same time, or that can be used in a sweet dish or a savory dish.
I really like the toppings that you put on the salad, Carrie. How you said that, like, you squeeze the lime and the zest mm-hmm. of ginger and then a little bit of drizzle of agave. That just sounds amazing.
Thank you. And I've seen different adaptations of the recipe where some people add chili, some people add coconut flakes, some people, instead of the agave nectar, they use honey. And I've tried it different ways, but I'm telling you, the little bit of squeeze of lime juice, because that'll keep your fruit fresh too and from turning. A zest, just take some fresh ginger. It's really key. Just grate a little bit, mix it in there, because a little goes a long way with ginger.
Yeah, you can find that out the hard way.
Yes. Yes.
Ginger, ginger. Mm-hmm.
And then the drizzle of the agave, and you can just slightly toss it and chill in a large fruit bowl or little tiny fruit bowls and serve it. And it's just adorable. You can garnish it with fresh mint if you want or not. And I think it will add a lot to your holiday celebration. And if you ever bring this fruit salad to like a barbecue or a party, it will be a hit. Everybody will be like, oh my God, what is this? How did you make this? This is so clever. So I highly recommend it. And I'm delighted to share it with our audience.
And on the blog, you can see the photo of this salad. It is outstandingly gorgeous.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't know how you make stars out of jicama though. Like
cookie cutter.
Yes, cookie cutter. You're right, Kiki.
That'd be a really tiny cookie cutter.
They're very tiny. Yeah, I don't know.
Cookie cutters come in all shapes and sizes.
They really do. Okay.
They make tiny ones?
Yes, they do make tiny cookie cutters.
Well, that sounds so delicious, Carrie. Is it Femblast trivia time, Kiki?
I think so.
All right.
On the last episode, we gave the trivia question. What woman was credited for inventing non-reflective glass known as the Langmuir Blanchet film, which is responsible for the crystal clear movies that are recorded today? And the answer is Catherine Burr Blanchet. She was an American physicist and chemist known for her work on surface chemistry, in particular her invention of quote unquote invisible or non-reflective glass while working at General Electric. She was the first woman to be awarded a PhD in physics from the University of Cambridge in 1926.
Go, Catherine.
Right? Wow. Blanchet used the Langmuir Blanchet film to create a 99% transparent anti-reflective glass by coating glass with fluorinated organic compounds, forming a simple anti-reflective coating. And in a typical imaging system, this improves the efficiency of the glass since less light is lost due to reflection. And in complex systems such as camera, binoculars, telescopes, and microscopes, the reduction in reflection also improves the contrast of the image by the elimination of stray light.
Whoa.
Right?
This is incredible. Catherine, I'm so impressed by you.
Yeah, she's amazing.
And the first woman to be awarded a PhD in physics from the University of Cambridge.
Amazing.
Okay, you know what I'm noticing about a lot of these women who are doing these amazing roles is a lot of them are STEM.
Totally.
Yes.
Kick-ass STEM women. Go, Jennifer. Yeah.
I love the STEM arts fusion, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Science and art.
Yeah.
They go together.
Yeah. And especially in this episode. And like you were saying, Carrie, about the history of it, of how much visual effects was optical effects.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you had to know the science and the math because all of these things like reflection and how we perceive things. It's fascinating.
Well, as a painter, Jennifer, I mean, I'm sure you could relate to that. They were maybe in their minds painting the visual effects, so to speak, with light and other color saturation, the other elements. It was more akin to painting than it was any other medium at the time, at least.
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
Wow, what a great question. Oh my gosh, what's the new one?
Ooh, next month, our focus will be on women screenwriters. So pencils up, heat seekers. I pose to you this question. What screenwriter was credited as the first female executive for Metro/MGM and at 35 was the highest paid executive in Hollywood?
What?
Ooh, power player.
Right.
All right.
If you know the answer, let us know on Hot Redhead Media, social media, when we post the question.
Well, I think that this whole episode is awesome and I'm excited for our listeners to hear it. Thank you for listening to Heat Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood. To check out our newest curated watch lists and episode snacks anytime, please visit www.hotredheadmedia.com for our blog posts. If you like the focus on women creators in film and TV, subscribe to Heat right now, Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood, for more episodes on women reshaping the narrative in Hollywood. Episodes release once a month. Thanks again for listening. Till next time, stay awesome.